carnage in the bond market continued today, triggering a sell-off in tech, with the Nasdaq down 2.5%, one of the 10 worst days of the index since July. Later, I'll be speaking to lithium bull Howard Klein about the critical role that lithium plays in electric vehicles and about how he's managing positions in stocks that are up as much as 1,000%. But first, bond yields are rising like a hot air balloon. Is the Fed going to lose control of the yield curve? That is the trillion-dollar question. And who better to make sense of it all than Lynn Alden? Lynn, welcome back to the Daily Briefing. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So a lot of action in the market today that I want to get into. So the 10-year continued to rise. Yields continue to rise. The 10-year is up 7 basis points. It's now at 1.46%. And accordingly, the Nasdaq is down almost 2%. We're seeing a lot of carnage in those growthy names, DocuSign, Zoom, Peloton, PayPal, all down over 5% today. How are you thinking about all of this market action?
Yeah, so basically what we're seeing play out is what I wrote about in my February newsletter. And so back on February 21st, I published a piece talking about how this rising yield situation could impact, kind of different sectors. And it kind of started with a flow chart, right? So, if you get a continued stimulus and things like that, you're looking at kind of continued reflation or the potential for outright inflation. On the other hand, if they were to cut off stimulus or the talks were to fall through, you could kind of cut that inflation theme off prematurely. And so basically the flow chart started with, assuming that they're going to continue with stimulus, we move on to the next round. And then the thing is, okay, so if we get more stimulus, we get rising inflation expectations, you should start to see the longer end of the curve start to move up because, for the past year, they've been submerged below the actual and expected inflation rate. And so even if you don't get high inflation, it would be natural for the long end of the curve to move up and go back towards even zero yields, let alone positive real yields. And so we're starting to see that play out. And then from there, it really is going to come down to what the monetary policymakers at the Fed do about this. And so if they don't intervene very heavily, then we're likely to continue to get steepening yield curve. And therefore, you'd want to be long things like banks, for example, and some of the other value plays, and short treasuries, if you want to play it like that. On the other hand, if you expect the Fed to kind of come in and intervene and either do an operation twist where they might sell some of their T-bills and buy some T-notes and T-bonds, or outright yield curve control in the more extreme sense, then that can, basically compress the long end of the curve and drive those real yields more, further back into negative territory. And so far, we're seeing that leg play out with the banks doing quite well, value outperforming growth, and a sell-off in treasuries.
Mm-hmm. Just for the people at home, so that operation twist is selling short the Fed, when the Fed sells short-term bonds and buys long-term bonds to sort of restore order to that yield curve that has steepened so much. Lynn, I want to ask you about the rotation into cyclical names. Banks are obviously cyclical. They do well when rates rise because they make money from rates. But energy companies as well, airlines, those cyclicals, I haven't heard you talk as positively about them. But if the market is pricing in robust growth, why is now not the time to plow into those value cyclical names?
Yeah, so I'm kind of selective with my cyclicals. And so, for example, I have been talking about energy for a while. And so I'm overweight energy. And because, if you look back in the summer of 2020, I mean, that was a really bombed out sector. We had the infamous, negative oil print in the spring. And then therefore, people called uninvestable. Sentiment couldn't be worse. We also commingled the narrative of Tesla and solar and kind of the idea that oil's out of here. I thought that whole thing was really overdone. And so I've been long energy, and there are a couple of different ways to do it. And so I prefer to focus on the high quality end of the cyclical trade. And so we often think of, different factors. Like if you think of quality, you generally think of uncyclical companies. But even in the cyclical space, there's a spectrum there, right? So for example, you can have an energy company that is virtually never free cash flow positive, barely has even when oil's doing okay, it's having a rough time, let alone when oil's in a bear market. But if you were to get an uptick in oil, that stock could really skyrocket. But that's not really the place I'm playing in. I'm focusing on the ones with low cost production, strong balance sheets, the one that can get through multiple bull and bear cycles. And so I've been overweight some of those higher quality energy names, such as some of the transporters and some of the producers. I haven't really been touching the airline stocks, although I have been long airports. It's kind of a wider moat way to play a similar theme. And I've also been reasonably long industrials. But really, the financials and the energy have been some of the more cyclical plays, along with broader commodities like copper and some of those other trades.
Mm. Lynn, I know that you you like these value stocks, and for cyclical reasons, because you expect growth to pick up alongside with inflation. And you've been right about that, by the way, that you go into those cyclical names. But I do know that you also like your tech stocks every now and then. Alibaba comes to mind. How are you thinking about managing that position where you think, okay, it's a good company, I like it, it's got growth prospects, but if all of its value is based in the future and rates are rising, the future isn't worth what it used to be. You know, how are you thinking about your exposure to tech?
So my overall approach with that area is growth at a reasonable price. So it's kind of that midpoint between, you know, unprofitable hypergrowth stocks. I think a lot of those are very overdone. I've been avoiding that space. On the other hand, you can get companies where if you look at their PEG ratio, their price to earnings to growth ratio, that's actually quite reasonable. And because, you know, the overall threat to the really kind of hypergrowth stocks is that they were bid up to extraordinarily high valuations, often 30, 40, 50 times sales. In order to justify those valuations, you need extremely high growth for the next decade. And you also need a very, very low discount rate to basically justify those valuations. And so when you get a rise in yields, basically the fair value calculations put a lot more pressure on those really expensive growth stocks than they do, on the other end of the spectrum, the value stocks, with, you know, profitable growth stocks being somewhere in the middle. And so I've been overweight the value side and focusing on that side of it. But I still am long certain growth at a reasonable price name. So, for example, I think, Alibaba, Tencent, JD out of China still look okay. In the United States, I have a small position of Microsoft, Amazon. And so I haven't fully abandoned that side of my portfolio. But, for example, I have a lower position in those compared to the S&P 500, which is quite concentrated in those very, large mega cap names. And so that combination of excluding those really unprofitable, high-valued companies and then being underweight some of those heavyweights really gives the portfolio more of a slant towards that value side without, you know, fully getting out of the growth at a reasonable price space.
Lynn, as we approach a close, how are you thinking about the bond market going forward? Obviously, we've had this tremendous sell-off in bonds, resulting in yields spiking. Last week, there was a seven-year bond sale of over $60 billion, and the marginal buyer was nowhere to be found, and it really was chaos. How are you thinking about that going forward? I think, you know, next week and the week after, we have some 10-year bond sales, some 30-year bond sales. Do you think that the marginal buyer is going to be there, or do you think that, you know, yields will continue to spike up like they have over the past 2 weeks and like we saw today?
So a week or two is hard to say. I don't really focus on the nuances of that particular time frame. But over the longer run, I'm still in kind of the bond bear camp, either from a real perspective or a nominal perspective. And so my base case would be a continued rise in yields unless the Fed takes more drastic actions to try to cap the long end of the curve, at which case it could prevent further nominal losses in bonds. But it's not a place I want to have in terms of purchasing power, in terms of real returns. I'd still rather be in some of these other types of assets. And so we have a couple of dates to watch. I mean, the big ones are going to be the FOMC meeting to see if they take any action or if they continue to let this play out. My overall base case for a while now is that the Fed basically is going to fish for a pain point. And so they're going to, you know, let yields partially do what they do, given, of course, the fact that they are still assisting it with, you know, $80 billion a month in purchases. But besides that, basically training wheels, they're saying, okay, we're going to see what's going to happen and let the market find pain points. And if things get too disorderly, you know, they step in at some degree. And we saw a taste of that last week. And then the question is, you know, will we continue to have disorderly periods like that, or will the rise be more gradual and allow the Fed to kind of, you know, stand back and just kind of, you know, talk it down, essentially?
Final question, Lynn. 2% is that number is being thrown around as the level above which the Fed can just simply not tolerate it and it will intervene. What do you think of that bogey? Obviously, no one knows where it really is, but do you think that's accurate in giving it a rough sense of once it passes that threshold, The Fed is going to do everything it takes to keep yields down. And, you know, I'm also thinking not just of Operation Twist or yield curve control, but also, what Zoltan Pozsar said today about, extending the emergency measures, which I think currently expire in March.
Yeah, so I think it's overall, I don't necessarily think they're going to focus on a specific price level or yield level, I should say. I think that's a reasonable kind of approximation of where they might start to intervene more. But in my view, it's less about the number and more about where it starts causing pain points in the market. So for the treasury market to become disorderly, illiquid, those are the types of things I'd look at more about raising my probability for Fed intervention. My base case is they'll probably extend the SLR rules change, that allows banks to essentially hold more treasuries, and the next high probability would, possibly an operation twist. And the reason there is because you ironically have a problem on both ends of the curve. On the short end of the curve, you actually have a shortage of T-bills compared to the amount of liquidity in the system. On the other end of the spectrum, you have, these rising yields putting some pressure on, some of these other parts of the market. And so they could potentially just, sell some T-bills, buy some T-bonds, T-notes, basically solve or at least, slow down both problems at the same time. But we'll see how proactive they end up being or whether or not they let the market just continue to find pain points and then put out fires as they come. Generally, my base case is that the Fed is a more reactive organization. And therefore, rather than trying to proactively get ahead of things, they'll let the market poke around and basically tell them what they have to do.
That's a very compelling framework. We'll have to leave it there. Lynn, thanks so much. Where can people find you on Twitter as well as on your website?
So I'm at lynnalden.com and active on Twitter at lynnaldencontact. Thanks for having me.
Of course, Lynn. Talk to you soon.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Howard, welcome to the Daily Briefing. How are you doing?
Very well, Jack. Thanks for having me on the show.
Of course. So you've been on with Ed, and you've been very bullish on lithium stocks. And since then, they have been on quite a run. So, you come back to Real Vision sort of with us rolling out a red carpet. So the lithium space has been on fire, in the wake of the EV frenzy and the flurry of SPACs that are going on. So, the wheels are really turning in that space. What's your current outlook on the lithium space?
Well, the lithium equity space is large. There's lots of investment opportunities in it, and it's generally very positive because the prices of lithium have only started rising a few months ago, and they're still, even though they've gone up in some cases 50, 100%, if it's lithium carbonate, lithium hydroxide, or precursor material spodumene, they're still below what is widely acknowledged to be the incentive price to expand capacity in a meaningful way. And the demand for lithium, as we've talked about before, it just keeps increasing. Albemarle, the largest lithium producer in the world, in their fourth quarter results a week or two ago, upgraded their 2025 forecast to 1.14 million tons of lithium carbonate equivalent. That number was 900,000 to a million prior to that. And a year prior to that, it was lower. It was like 700 or 800. So every year, the demand forecasts for lithium are increasing in a nearer term timeframe. And 2025 is only 4 years away. The market for lithium last year was only about 350,000 tons. So that's a tripling of lithium supply in 4 years. And then if you look out to 2030, it needs to double again from that 1.1, 4 million. So another million tons. And this is without taking into account, Elon Musk and Tesla's very aggressive, 3 terawatt hour, forecast for battery capacity for Tesla alone. So the outlook is ridiculously strong for lithium demand, because lithium is such a small industry. It's only been about a $3 or $4 billion industry, not a lot of tons compared to, the oil industry, iron ore, copper, nickel. All of those industries are much bigger than lithium. So it's the small base that is growing so rapidly, 20% per year, as far as the eye can see, that is making the backdrop for lithium to be, very exciting sector. And the prices, which were on a downward trajectory the last 2.5 years, have started rising as demand, as inventories have depleted, and as Europe in particular has, and China following, have implemented policies that are very pro-EV, and the numbers coming in on a monthly basis from Europe in various countries, UK, Germany, et cetera, are 15-20% EV penetration rates. And you've had recently more and more major auto companies are setting targets for the elimination of internal combustion engine vehicles. So I think Jaguar said 2025, they're no longer going to make internal combustion engine cars. Volvo, Ford, GM, I forget exactly the dates, but 2025, 2030, by 2035, the latest, the elimination of the internal combustion engine car in a very short period of time. That's a huge amount of batteries that are needed, and all of those batteries require lithium.
Howard, with regards to Albemarle, it's as you say, the largest lithium company, but they're diversified. They've got, I think, 3 sectors. In addition to lithium, they've got catalysts and then bromines. What can you tell me about the sort of pure lithium plays? You mentioned Piedmont, but then I think you also have your eye on Livent, which just recently reported earnings as well. What do you make? What's your outlook on Piedmont and Livent?
Okay, the last time I spoke with Ed, I said Livent, in my opinion, was a hold, and Albemarle was a buy and Piedmont was a buy. I suggested Piedmont could be a $100 stock. I suggested Albemarle could be a $200 stock. So Albemarle is at 155. Piedmont's actually close to 100 already. And Livent has kind of like treaded water. So I'm still sticking to all of that guidance. Livent's quarter was not great. They had $6 million in EBITDA. Their main asset is in Argentina, and they don't have any volume growth in the short term. They only have price growth, and I think the company is reasonably well managed. But their investments, they have to make some significant investments. I also think they're likely to raise equity. Albemarle, since I spoke to Ed, did raise $1.5 billion to, shore up their balance sheet, reduce debt, but also invest in very near term, growth that they have. And SQM, another company I haven't mentioned before, but they raised or are raising $1.1 billion. The equity capital raising business, I keep track of all this. I think $4.4 billion has been raised in just equity alone across, 20 or 30 different lithium companies since last August. So I'm not super bullish on the outlook. I think the valuation of lithium, of Livent remains high. I think Albemarle is still a buy. I mean, the stock hasn't moved that much, and they have the best assets and they have volume and price growth. Piedmont has performed spectacularly well, and I believe people are starting to recognize it. It's a billion market cap now. It's a pre-production company. But if you compare it to EV-themed SPAC companies, right, and like MP Materials, which is a rare earths company, has like a $7 billion market cap for hard rock rare earths mine in California. Here you have a hard rock lithium mine in North Carolina. I think, you know, you could see a trajectory that it could easily grow into MP Materials valuation, you know, over the next several years. So I think the market's starting to understand that Piedmont is not just a project, but it's a business. It's not just a one asset company. Since we've spoken last time, they actually made a small investment for $12 million in a Quebec lithium mine where they got 40% of the economics. So they're implementing their strategy of not just their North Carolina project, but potentially being a consolidator and multi-mine and multi-chemical plant producer. So the market believes Piedmont's going to be a 20,000 ton producer, but they could be, you know, 100,000 ton producer with a, you know, a 7 to 10 year view. So I continue to like Piedmont as a long term and medium term investment. Again, the stock has risen, you know, a lot, but it has scarcity value as the only American. They're redomiciling. It's an Australian listed company with a U.S. ADR, but they're now redomiciling to be 100% American company. It'll be the only 100%, you know, owned and listed developer in lithium. This will enable it to join indexes like the Russell 2000 and the like. And bear in mind, just I want to say, because other people have commented in the past, we are an advisor to Piedmont. I'm an investor in Piedmont. I've been involved with the company for some, you know, 4 years, from 10 million market cap now to a billion. But I continue to be involved with the company. So, you know, do your own research, and just wanted to make that the disclosure.
Thanks, Howard. You mentioned MP Materials, and that makes me think about this rating issue. Do these rare earth stocks, these lithium equities, these miners, do they trade, Howard, as commodities, or do they trade as electric vehicle stocks? And I ask because, you know, everyone now is talking about rising interest rates, and rising interest rates are kind of kryptonite to growth stocks, and particularly electric vehicle stocks, which are epitomes of growth stocks. So, you know, if interest rates rise and they're trading like EV stocks, that perhaps could be negative for these lithium companies. However, if they trade like a commodity stock, like let's say an oil stock that's really focused on reflation and growth, and that, you know, reflation and growth will be a tailwind, then rising interest rates will be good. So, Howard, how do you see the lithium sector trading relative to interest rates?
That's a very interesting question. So Albemarle stock has risen significantly because I believe people are looking beyond just next year's earnings, and they've started to look to 2025 in the same way that these EV SPACs are being valued on their 2024-2025 EBITDA. So you mentioned Tesla has profits, right? A lot of these SPACs don't even have revenue yet, right? So will rising interest rates puncture the valuations of the SPAC market and the valuations there? I'm not sure. I think the broader theme of sustainability, clean energy, ESG, which since Biden got elected, and we now have, you know, Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm is talking about an industrial policy toward EVs, batteries, and also mined materials. I'm not answering your question directly. You take an MP Materials. I think MP Materials is being valued as an EV play. More than it's as a commodity play. And if you look at the presentation that they have put out there during their SPAC, they benchmark themselves not only to lithium companies and commodity companies, but to Tesla and other ways to play the EV theme. So Morgan Stanley just initiated coverage of MP Materials. 2 weeks ago, Morgan Stanley put out a new sustainability framework that talks about green premiums in the same way that Bill Gates has written a book about green premiums. They're arguing that certain stocks that are tied to this sustainability, clean energy, green thematic should have higher multiples. So in their initiation of coverage of MP Materials, they, I forget the number, but they said it should trade at like 50 times earnings, which is three times higher because it deserves a green premium. A mining company, because it's tied to EV, is green. If that's true, if Morgan Stanley's telling the world that, they should also be telling the world that about lithium. They've been big lithium bears, but Albemarle, in Goldman Sachs's framework, is a sustained 50 name of Goldman Sachs. I would think that Albemarle should be a sustainable green premium name and get an upgrade from Morgan Stanley. But to your, and Piedmont falls into that category as well. So, but to your point of many other lithium companies that are not listed in the US, that are listed in Australia or listed in Canada, their market caps are 1/10, you know, of what MP Materials or even Piedmont, well, maybe not 1/10, but like they're significantly discounted value to the stocks that are happening in the United States. And then if you look at big cap mining, if you look at BHP, Rio Tinto, these companies are paying like 5-6% dividend yields. They're trading at 5-7 times EV to EBITDA. They're paying special dividends rather than investing in massive growth. In Rio Tinto's case, I own Rio Tinto. They paid a special dividend because they're making so much money in iron ore. Copper prices are up. Nickel prices are up. I mean, So if you're worried about inflation, I recommend that I own a substantial holding of mine is an ETF called PICK, P-I-C-K. This is not gold. This is not oil. It's mined commodities for all the reasons that I just mentioned. We talked about a few other people like Kathy Wood at ARK Invest argue that disruptive innovation is deflationary, right? So she's less worried about inflation on balance than people like Michael Burry and Ray Dalio and others are worried about inflation. I'm more in that latter camp. I do worry about inflation, but mining can't be disrupted, right? So if you want like a safe haven, if you're worried about rising interest rates going to hurt Tesla's valuation or other tech stocks' valuation, a safe haven, okay, is to invest in mined commodities, and PICK is a broadly diversified way. And then the EV-themed commodities, the graphites, the nickels, the lithiums, it's hard to play producing nickel companies. It's hard to play, like in lithium, there's at least a few producers. In graphite, it's almost impossible to get exposure to graphite.
Why is that? Sorry to interrupt, Howard. Why is that the case? Why is it hard to get exposure to graphite companies?
Because 100% of graphite production is in China, which is a major problem. Okay, so I have all these scoreboards you mentioned, Jack, or you reached out to me because of these scoreboards. The graphite scoreboards are all like kind of like developers, right? Or one or two are producing, but they're brand new producers. So there's a security of supply, issue here. There's a China, non-China kind of element to it. So what I'm saying is that I don't know that graphite are necessarily inflation hedge investments, but they are battery themed investments, and they're trading at very low valuations. Even though some companies, we represent a company in graphite called Nouveau-Monde Graphite. It's listed in Canada. Its operations are in Canada, but it has a very liquid, OTC ticker symbol, OTC, stock in the U.S. That stock has gone up 10 times, but it's gone from like, 40 million market cap to 400 million market cap. So it's still, 40% of Piedmont's valuation and what, like a 70 or 80% discount to MP's valuation. So, and I don't think that that's necessarily an inflation play, right? It's a battery themed play. and it's not starting from a very high valuation. So if inflation ticks up and tech stocks fall, I don't think it should impact negatively the graphite names or the nickel names. In fact, I think the market will start to understand the whole asset class as a bit of a safe haven, right? It's been 10 years since mined commodities have had a boom, and it's a long cycle sector. So after 10 years of a great, you know, the 2002 to 2011 was great under the Obama stimulus in 2009 and 10, that's when the top of the market, the commodity market happened. From 2012 to last year, it's been a bear market on balance. So you've had disinvestment, you've had, return money to shareholders, you know, shore up your balance sheet mentality, not invest in growth is what investors in BHP, Rio Tinto, et cetera, have been telling those companies. Now they're going to be telling those companies, invest in growth. And when they invest in growth, they're investing in sustainability. ESG is extremely top of the list of importance to all of these mining companies. So to the extent that interest rate rises are a worry in the market, and they worry me, I'm not exposed. I don't have a lot of tech investments. I have mostly natural resource investments. I think they're going to perform extremely well because the valuations are so low. And if any sector is poised for a re-rating, like overnight, Rio Tinto could go from a 6x multiple to a 10x multiple and not be perceived as being expensive. And the assets that they own, world class, are not replaceable, right? A mm-hmm. Lucid or a Fisker or a Hylion, you know, any one of these, you know, whiteboarded companies, you know, they're not all going to succeed, right? But if you have a world-class lithium mine, you have a world-class graphite mine, okay, that's scarce. Piedmont is scarce. And anyway, that's my view on a long-winded answer to your inflation consideration.
Not long-winded, Howard, very detailed. And I thank you for that detail. You mentioned the Nikolas of the world, and that's a great transition. So you also have a scoreboard of the SPACs, the EV SPACs. So, you know, that's QuantumScape, Luminar, Nikola, Lordstown Motors. And, you know, these companies, as you mentioned, are perhaps a little bit more exposed to interest rates because many of them are pre-profit, if not pre-revenue. So what stands out to you among this space? You mentioned you're not as active as you are with lithium, but, you know, you made a scorecard, so you are interested in a little bit. You know, what stands out to you?
Well, I'm very interested in it because, you know, the mining companies are correlated to that dynamic. And I think the SPAC phenomenon is as strong as it is in part because interest rates have been so low. If you're an investor, you could park your money in a SPAC, you put the money to work, you earn the fees. If you're a hedge fund, instead of sitting in cash and earning nothing, you make an investment in a SPAC, you're making a fee on the investment in the SPAC. That SPAC money is sitting in cash, right? But so I think very low interest rates have spurred SPAC issuance to this enormous amount that it has. And then they have to deploy a lot of the capital. So they're putting the capital into more risky targets, right? Targets that used to be, or they're venture capital funded. So I did well with MP Materials. I bought that company after the deal announcement, but that stock didn't pop the way Nikola popped, right? Within a few days, you know, the stock was only at like 11, you know, not 20, you know, from a $10 price. So I did very well, right? I bought at 11 and a half. I sold a lot of it at 20. I sold a bit more at 30. It's now at 40. I'm holding the last remnant of it.
I think it breached 50 today.
It did it really?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so, you know, but there's a lot of rare earth dynamic. You know, it's not just EV thematic. There's a lot of politics going on and fear in the rare earths market with China. So So that's what got me really focused. I started the SPAC scoreboard, you know, as that happened. And we now have 32 EV themed SPACs broken down into EV companies, five categories: EV, battery, LiDAR, charging, and materials. And in addition to MP Materials, there's a recycling company, friends of mine, actually, Li-Cycle, you know, is going public with a company, with a SPAC called PDAC. That stock hasn't performed that well. In the battery space, one that I'm watching is Alusa merged with Freyr, which is a Norwegian battery company that has a Norway has hydroelectric power. So they're advertising themselves as not only, you know, super low cost battery, but also super low carbon footprint. I never saw like there was a cost curve in their presentation, which is not a cost curve. It's based on the carbon intensity. So batteries, you know, are perceived, you know, can be produced in a clean way. They could be produced in a less clean way. So this company just received, you know, a grant of about $10 or $12 million from the Norwegian government. Glencore is involved, you know, wrote into the pipe. Koch Strategic Ventures wrote into the pipe. You know, unlike QuantumScape, which is whatever, I don't know, 20, 30 billion market cap, this Alusa is trading like when I entered MP Materials at $11, this is only trading at like $10.40, right? The merger hasn't yet consummated. So your downside, if you invest with a very short term time frame, like before the merger, your downside is only $10, right? So I think there's some asymmetric risk reward if you follow the story and get educated about it. I think it's an interesting play on our scoreboard.
So that's Alusa, which merged with Freyr. That's something to look into. Howard, you have a hot hand.
What's also relevant about that stock, it is tied to what I do, right? They are talking about sustainably purchasing materials. So they mentioned lithium. They mentioned like Glencore's in the pipe for that company. I imagine Glencore is probably interested to supply them cobalt, right? Mm-hmm. We're also in the EV market. There's not only complaints about you know, chip shortages, but there's concern about battery shortages. Battery shortages, people are going to be talking about raw material shortages as a way to play a battery shortage. There's not that many ways to play batteries, right? Directly in a pure play. So I have to do a lot more homework on Freyr, to be honest. Fundamentally, mm-hmm. this is still many years away from generating revenue. And I need to understand the technology better, but as a pure short-term trade, it can't go lower than $10 before merger consummation, right? And it's at $10.40 today. And it's possible, you know, the market for SPACs, because of the interest rate worries that you talked about, had a very bad 2 to 3 last weeks. And the last time this happened in SPAC land was just before the election. October was not a good month for SPACs. And then post Biden winning, it was game on again. So I'm wondering how, you know, Chairman Powell said, don't worry, we're not raising interest rates. You know, the market might be forcing his hand. Mm-hmm. But I think we could have, you know, another leg up in SPAC enthusiasm in the next kind of couple of weeks and months in a similar way you had November, December, you know, January. So my call on Alusa is very short term. Okay. I haven't done full homework, you know, on the Freyr, you know, the bottom up company perspective. You can't go lower than $10 before merger consummation. So that's behind this recommendation.
It's good you had that disclaimer, Howard. And you know, I really want to have you back on for a full interview because this is the daily briefing. We only have so much time. I specifically want to ask you about the SPAC world, where, you know, A-Rod has a SPAC, Shaq has a SPAC, Paul Ryan has a SPAC. It's a pretty wild and crazy world. So, you know, I'm looking at your scorecard. You're a pro. You've been in this space. You can separate the wheat from the chaff, and you're willing to take risks, and your clients take that risk too. But, you know, I'm worried about someone who maybe I want to ask you if you have worries about, you know, sort of the retail investor. But we're going to have to leave that for another day. Howard, it was wonderful having you on the Daily Briefing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Jack, thanks for having me, and very happy to come back and talk about those and many other issues.
Thanks. Talk soon.